Reading Capital as Crisis Theory. Economic crisis is a troublesome phenomenon for the defenders of capitalism. The problem is not simply the curtailment of economic activities and the bankruptcies and unemployment that ensue. A far bigger problem is ideological, because the undeniable reality of crisis exposes that capitalism is not, as economists insist, the ideal engine for satisfying human needs through the creation of wealth. Crisis exposes the limits imposed on wealth creation by production for profit, limits, incidentally, that are always present in capitalism, whether in boom times or bust. Crisis is the real negation of the argument that capitalism is the ideal means of developing the productive forces of society, an argument that dates back to the emergence of political economy in the 18th century. Adam Smith begins his great work, The Wealth of Nations, by praising capitalism as the most efficient way to raise the productive power of labor. To be more precise, he uses the term the division of labor, not capitalism. But what he has in mind is independent producers creating commodities for the market, a state of affairs that he says gradually emerged from a human propensity to truck, barter, and exchange one thing for another. David Ricardo, that other great classical economist, shared Smith's faith in the ability of capitalism to freely develop productive power, and he was fortunate, in a sense, to die at the early age of 51 in 1823, because had he lived just 2 years longer, Ricardo would have confronted the crisis of 1825, considered the first economic crisis to clearly arise from the workings of capitalism itself, rather than some external cause. The periodic general crises of the sort that followed in the 19th century would have put Ricardo's faith in capitalism to a severe test. The reality of crisis did indeed test the economists who came after Ricardo, forcing them to choose between continuing to extol the virtues of capitalism or seriously considering the implications of periodic crises, since the livelihoods of most depended on not understanding those implications. This marked the emergence of what Marx called the vulgar economists, those hired prize fighters who abandoned genuine scientific research to instead act as apologists for capitalism. Each time a crisis occurs, economists point to some external or contingent factor as the cause for the temporary disruption of the supposedly splendid ability of capitalism to self-regulate on the basis of supply and demand. Marx, in contrast, explains economic crises that regularly take place as a normal manifestation of the accumulation process. He points to the inherent tendency of capitalism toward crisis, which underscores the limitations of this mode of production. An understanding of the significance of crisis is thus at the core of Marx's investigation of capitalism. Marx had in fact intended to write an entire book on crisis. We know this from the plans he sketched for a critique of political economy in the 1850s. According to his 1857 version of the plan, a book on the world market and crises was to be the sixth and final book of the critique, following the other books on capital, landed property, wage labor, the state, and foreign trade. Marx never completed or even began that book, however, so he has not left us a coherent, systematic theory of crisis. Nevertheless, as I'll try to make clear in this talk, we can consider the three volumes of Marx's great work, Capital, as broadly constituting a theory of crisis. The importance of crisis to the overall investigation of capitalism will come into sharper focus if we consider how Marx generally defined crisis. In his manuscript, Theories of Surplus Value, Marx defines the crises of the world market as the real concentration and forcible adjustment of all the contradictions of bourgeois production, and says that those contradictions are strikingly revealed in a crisis. In a contribution to the Critique of Political Economy, we can find a description of how the antagonism of all elements in the bourgeois process of production explode in the crises of the world market. And in the third volume of Capital, Marx describes the crises of the world market as the momentary, violent solutions for the existing contradictions. Crisis for Marx, in short, is an explosion of all the contradictions of capitalism that brings about a temporary resolution of those contradictions, so that through crisis, the fundamental limitations of capitalism are exposed. This suggests that a theory of crisis must clarify all the contradictions of capitalism. This is also the task that Marx undertakes in Capital, where he unravels the fundamental contradictions of capitalism, starting from the contradiction of the commodity as a unity of use value and exchange value. Reading Capital as crisis theory, in other words, centers on coming to grips with the contradictory nature of capitalism that is manifested in a crisis. Of course, unraveling all the contradictions that explode in a crisis is easier said than done. So immediately we face the question of what step to take first in reading Capital as crisis theory. Fortunately, Marx has left us a passage in Theories of Surplus Value that outlines a basic approach to the investigation of crisis. This passage can be found in volume 32 of the collected works of Marx and Engels, starting from around page 140. In the passage, Marx indicates that the first step toward understanding crisis is a recognition of what he calls the abstract form of crisis, or the general abstract possibility of crisis, that already exists under simple commodity circulation. The basis for the possibility of crisis at the most abstract level, he explains, is the fact that there can be a divergence between sale and purchase. This is something that Marx also points out in the first volume of Capital, where he notes that sale and purchase can diverge since no one directly needs to purchase because he has just sold. In other words, a person who obtains money by means of selling a commodity is under no obligation to immediately use that money to purchase some other commodity. By indicating this fact, Marx was refuting what he called the foolish dogma of the French economist Jean-Baptiste Say, who had insisted that sales and purchases, and hence supply and demand, are in equilibrium because every sale is a purchase, and every purchase a sale. This was the popular argument used to deny the possibility of overproduction, which Ricardo also adhered to. It is true, of course, that in the case of barter, a direct identity exists between the exchange of one's own product and the acquisition of the product of someone else. No one can be a seller without being a buyer, or a buyer without being a seller. Marx points out how the introduction of money splits that unity of direct exchange into the two antithetical segments of sale and purchase, allowing circulation to burst through all the temporal, spatial, and personal barriers imposed by the direct exchange of products. The introduction of money brings to the surface the latent contradiction under barter between the desire to obtain a specific use value and the desire to obtain a product of equivalent value. In other words, the contradiction between use value and exchange value. The mediation of money, which splits exchange into the two separate acts of sale and purchase, gives this contradiction room to move, as Marx puts it, and in turn generates the possibility of crisis. But Marx is careful to note that the divergence of sale and purchase cannot be viewed as the direct cause of crisis. Rather, it merely denotes the formal possibility of crisis, or what he calls the most abstract form of crisis, without content, without a compelling motivating factor. In the same methodological passage in Theories of Surplus Value, Marx presents a second form of crisis related to the divergence of sale and purchase. This is the possibility of crisis arising from money's function as a means of payment. This function of money, which is explained in Chapter 3 of Capital, concerns transactions in which a seller hands over a commodity to a buyer while providing a promise to pay money at a later date, so that the seller becomes a creditor and the buyer a debtor. In other words, the function of money as a means of payment is at the basis of credit. Money as a means of payment allows for sale and purchase to diverge even further, as if the rope connecting them were replaced by a bungee cord. The time gap between the handing over of a commodity and the payment of money for it raises the possibility for more problems to arise. Marx notes that if in the interval between the handing over and the payment, the value has changed, so that the money is not worth as much at the time of its sale as it was worth at the moment when money was acting as a measure of value, then the obligation cannot be met from the proceeds of the sale of the commodity, and therefore the whole series of transactions which retrogressively depend on this one transaction cannot be settled. In other words, the failure to make good on one promise to pay can set off a chain reaction leading to other failures to settle debts. This second form of crisis based on money as a means of payment is more concrete than the first, but still quite abstract, Marx emphasizes. Neither the first nor the second form of crisis can be considered a direct cause of crisis. Rather, they are what Marx calls the most generalized expression of crisis, or its abstract possibility. He explains that the abstract form of crisis only implies that the framework for a crisis exists, but does not contain the factors that transform the possibility of crisis into an actual crisis. A whole series of other conditions is required in order for the possibility of crisis to develop into actuality. And those conditions do not yet exist, Marx says, from the standpoint of the simple circulation of commodities. We have seen then that even at the level of commodity circulation, there is the potential of a disruption or crisis. Conversely, in a moneyless society, where production is directly for use with no market mediation, this possibility of crisis would not exist. In order to better understand the relation between capitalism and crisis, we have to move beyond this abstract understanding of the potential for crisis. So here we face the question of how to take the next step toward understanding crisis more concretely. We can get some hints from the same passage in Theories of Surplus Value. Marx points out there that abstract forms of crisis receive what he calls a content or a basis on which to manifest themselves in the circulation/reproduction process of capital. This means that we need to move on to Volume 2 of Capital, where Marx examines that process. Marx had to set aside the circulation process of capital in Volume 1 so that he would be able to purely examine the immediate production process. That is to say, in order to clarify what goes on in the production process, he had to assume that capitalists have unhindered access to the needed means of production and labor power, and can also sell their commodities at their value to realize the surplus value contained in them. This means that he had to assume that the circulation/reproduction process proceeds smoothly. In Volume 2, however, Marx shifts his attention to the circulation process that he had set aside, so as to examine the circuit of capital from three different starting points: money capital, productive capital, and commodity capital. Marx explains in the passage in Theories of Surplus Value that the two abstract forms of crisis, identified in the process of simple commodity circulation, reappear or are repeated under the circulation process of capital. But now the content of those forms is more developed or complex. This is because capital circulation is clearly more complex than simple commodity circulation. Whereas simple commodity circulation, or commodity, money, commodity, CMC, is nothing more than the exchange of commodities mediated by money, the circulation of capital involves capital in its continual movement, taking on and casting off the forms of money, elements of production, and commodity. The significance of this added complexity as far as crisis theory is concerned is that there are more possibilities for sale and purchase to diverge under the circulation of capital as compared to simple commodity circulation. In Volume 2 of Capital, we can find many examples of how the abstract forms of crisis could acquire what Marx calls a content or basis on which to manifest themselves. For instance, in the course of the circulation and reproduction of capital, the value of the elements of production, or labor power and the means of production, can fluctuate, making it difficult to carry out production at the previous scale. Another way in which the possibility of crisis acquires a more specific content is that capitalists must build up funds for the sake of accumulation and the replacement of constant capital. so they have to hoard money, which means that they make sales without subsequent purchases, an example of sale diverging from purchase. Yet another example concerns large-scale projects such as the building of a highway or railroad, which for many years require purchases without sales or demand without supply. We can see then that the analysis of the circulation of capital in Volume 2 points to some of the potential problems that can arise, thus revealing how the abstract forms of crisis acquire a more specific content. So we have taken some steps toward a more concrete understanding of crisis under capitalism, but it is important to note that we are still only dealing with the possibility of crisis. What has not been made clear yet is what factors transform that possibility into actuality. That is a step that brings us to Volume 3 of Capital. Considering what factors transform the possibility of crisis into actuality concerns the fundamental contradiction of capitalism. Various conceptions of what this contradiction underlying crisis might be have been put forth by followers of Marx. Many have looked to a contradiction between production and consumption, usually expressed more specifically as the contradiction between the production of surplus value and its realization, or a contradiction between increased commodity production and the limited consumption power of workers. This is the foundation, in other words, of theories of underconsumption, which have pointed to a line from Volume 3 of Capital, where Marx writes, "The ultimate reason for all real crises always remains the poverty and restricted consumption of the masses in the face of the drive of capitalist production to develop the productive forces as if only the absolute consumption capacity of society set a limit to them." Of course, Marx is not saying that one would only need to remove that restricted consumption to eliminate or prevent crises. This is in fact hardwired into the system of capitalism, as profits depend on workers creating more value than the value of the commodities that they consume to reproduce their capacity to work. What we are dealing with, in other words, when it comes to a contradiction between production and consumption, however defined, is actually a permanent condition or premise of capitalist production, and as such, something that does not really explain what transforms the possibility of crisis into actuality or the periodic nature of crisis. Another fundamental contradiction that has been put forth to explain crisis is the conflict between the socialized production under capitalism and the private appropriation of products. This is an idea presented by Engels in his pamphlet, Socialism, Utopian or Scientific, where he describes the capitalist mode of production as being in rebellion against the mode of exchange due to a contradiction between socialized production and capitalist appropriation. But here again, we are dealing with a permanent situation or condition of capitalism that does not really clarify what factors actively transform the possibility of crisis into actuality. In Volume 3 of Capital, Marx presents a different and more dynamic conception of a contradiction at the heart of capitalism, explaining that the unrestricted development of the forces of production, which is the means, comes into persistent conflict with its restricted end, which is the valorization of existing capital. And in this sense, the true barrier to capitalist production is capital itself. In the manuscript later published under the title Grundriss, Marx similarly writes that capital by nature posits a barrier to labor and value creation in contradiction to its tendency to expand them boundlessly, and that insofar as capital posits a barrier specific to itself, while at the same time tries to drive over and beyond every barrier, it is a living contradiction. Unlike the static contradictions presented by Engels and other Marxists, which only describe conditions of capitalist production, contradiction Marx depicts is one that is dynamic and in active movement, and thus a living contradiction. Simply put, there is the powerful drive to develop the productive forces as the means of obtaining surplus value that comes up against and seeks to overcome the barrier imposed by capitalism as a system of production for profit. Crisis is seen as the explosion resulting from this collision. Of course, this description of the fundamental living contradiction is very abstract, so we need to consider more specifically the drive of capital to develop productive power. This is something that Marx touches on already in the first volume of Capital, where he explains that when individual capitalists or capitalist firms raise the productivity of labor, it drives the individual value of the commodities produced below the general market value. The advantage of this is that the commodities can then be sold below the prevailing market value, but above their individual value, so that an extra surplus value can be pocketed. This can also force competing capitalists out of business if they are unable to introduce new production methods or technologies to increase their own labor productivity. This analysis in Volume 1 shows that capital has what Marx calls an immanent drive and a constant tendency towards increasing the productivity of labor. But that drive is only a means to an end, the end being profit, of course. And in Volume 1, Marx clarified the fundamental limits imposed by the profit system, including the need to restrict workers' consumption that I touched on a moment ago. So already in Volume 1, we are presented with the basic elements of what could be described as the fundamental contradiction underlying the tendency toward crisis. We are shown what drives the development of productive power, while also learning about the limits of capitalism as a system of profit that both shapes and restricts that development. But since the aim of Volume 1 is to clarify the immediate production process, Marx does not concern himself with examining the various factors that come into actual conflict when capital's drive to raise productive power collides with its own imminent barrier as self-valorizing value. It is only in Volume 3 of Capital, where Marx examines the concrete forms of capital and surplus value within the total process of capital, that he can finally consider the conflicting factors that turn the possibility of crisis into reality. That analysis in Volume 3 can be found in Part 3, titled The Law of the Tendential Fall in the Rate of Profit, particularly Chapter 15, Development of the Law's Internal Contradictions. The Law of the Tendential Fall in the Rate of Profit shows that as the productivity of labor increases through the introduction of new technologies and machinery, the variable capital expended to purchase labor power in the form of wages tends to decrease in proportion to the constant capital expended on machinery and other means of production. Marx uses the term constant capital to refer to the means of production, incidentally, because the value of this capital is simply transferred to the commodity produced, rather than representing the creation of new value. In contrast, the term variable capital is used to refer to the labor power purchased because its actual expenditure as living labor creates new surplus value. We can see many examples from economic history of how the proportion of variable to constant capital tends to decrease over time. For example, the automobile factories in operation today utilize far more machinery compared to workers than they did even a few decades earlier, meaning a decrease in expenditures on wages compared to expenditures on the means of production. Marx says that as proportionally more capital is invested in the means of production, or constant capital, compared to the expenditure on wages, or variable capital, the rate of profit will tend to fall. In order to understand the logic here, it is necessary to understand the difference between the rate of profit and the rate of surplus value. The rate of surplus value, which expresses the degree of labor exploitation, is the sum of the total surplus value divided by variable capital. For instance, if workers receiving £100 in wages receive £100 in surplus value, the rate of surplus value would be 100%. The profit rate, meanwhile, is calculated by dividing that total surplus value by both variable capital and constant capital. So even with the same rate of exploitation, the rate of profit will vary depending on the amount of constant capital invested. And the greater the constant capital relative to the variable capital, the lower the profit rate will be. The significance of the tendency for the rate of profit to fall as a result of increased outlays on the means of production is not, however, as some Marxists argue, that it directly explains the cause of crisis. Crisis is not a simple phenomenon that arises from a fall in the rate of profit. The primary relevance to crisis theory of Marx's discussion of the tendency of the profit rate to fall is that it clarifies the conflicting factors within capital accumulation, showing us how the drive to increase productivity plays out in reality under capitalism. It might seem odd at first glance that capital would seek to increase productive power through introducing new technologies and production methods if the end result would be to drive down the rate of profit. But it is not so strange if we consider the motivation of individual capitals. As already mentioned, the motivation for increasing productivity is to obtain extra surplus value by selling commodities above their value but below their market value, with the added benefit that underselling competitors can drive them to the wall by forcing them to reduce the prices of commodities that were produced under more labor-intensive methods in order to sell them. Of course, those competitors will attempt whenever possible to raise their own productive power to produce commodities as cheaply or even cheaper. As the new, more productive methods become the norm in an industry, so that more can be produced with less labor, the rate of profit will tend to decline. But Marx describes the decline in the rate of profit as a double-edged law because it is coupled with an increase in the absolute mass of profit. The decline in the profit rate comes from the increased investment in the means of production, but through the greater amount of capital invested, it is possible, and indeed necessary, to obtain an equal or greater amount of profit despite the lower profit rate. Clearly, this situation is advantageous to larger capitalists capable of that increased investment. In contrast, smaller capitalists that struggle to raise the minimum amount of capital needed for production on an increased scale under a lower profit rate will be forced into desperate speculation and swindles to survive. The smaller capitalists, unable to act on their own, will go out of business and their capital will become available to the larger capitalists, while their unemployed workers flow into the surplus population of workers. The larger capitalists that survive are in a position to increase their mass of profit from the larger scale of production despite the fall in the rate of profit. So there is a dynamic at play where the advance of individual capital accumulation increases the proportion of constant to variable capital, which tends to cause the rate of profit to fall. And the lower rate of profit in turn spurs further capital accumulation and the concentration of capital, as smaller capital is unable to keep up and is absorbed within the larger capital. This is the relation that exists between the accumulation of capital and the rate of profit, and Marx describes accelerated accumulation and the fall in the rate of profit as simply different expressions of the same process, insofar as both express the development of productivity. It should be clear that the overproduction of commodities can easily arise from this frenzied drive to increase productive power, even despite the flexibility gained through the expansion of markets and the extension of credit. But the term overproduction certainly does not mean that the excess is with regard to the actual needs of the population, as if the working class were awash in wealth. Quite the contrary. As always, too little is produced to satisfy the needs of the mass of the population. Overproduction also does not mean that there are more means of production than could be utilized by the potential working population in order to create useful things. Marx says that the excess in commodities is only in relation to the amount of surplus value contained in them that can be realized under the conditions of capitalist distribution, while the excess of the means of production is only with regard to their functioning as a means of exploiting workers at a certain rate of profit. In short, as Marx is careful to point out, it is not that too much wealth is produced, but that from time to time too much wealth is produced in its capitalist antagonistic forms. What determines the expansion or contraction of production, Marx says, is not the proportion between production and social or individual needs. Rather, the determining factor is the appropriation of unpaid labor and the proportion between this unpaid labor and objectified labor in general, which can be expressed in capitalist terms as profit, and the proportion between profit and the total capital applied, which is the rate of profit. Marx describes the reality of these determining factors as constituting a barrier imposed by the capitalist mode of production. The problem of crisis is thus not so much a question of the physical overproduction of commodities as the overproduction of capital itself, which Marx describes as an overproduction of the means of production only insofar as these function as capital. This means that capital is no longer able to exploit labor at the level of exploitation required by the so-called healthy and normal development of the capitalist production process, which is a level of exploitation that allows the mass of profit to increase along with the increase in the mass of capital invested. When instead there is a fall in the level of exploitation below a certain point, the result, Marx argues, is a disruption in the capitalist production process, a crisis, and the destruction of capital. The disruption that occurs from the overproduction of capital takes place despite human needs remaining unmet, and the material conditions already being in place to produce goods to meet those needs. This is the absurd situation revealed in a crisis that exposes how capitalism is holding back human progress. There is no question that capitalism has developed the productive power of labor to a remarkable extent, which is precisely why Marx described this as capital's historical mission and justification. But from the analysis in Volume 3 of Capital, we can see how the essential motivation for the development of productive forces has nothing to do directly with the satisfaction of human needs. The defenders of capitalism make it seem as if profit, money, commodity exchange, and the rest of it is just a convenient means for producing useful things. But the reality is just the opposite. Producing useful things is just a means of obtaining profit. And when it is not possible to obtain sufficient profit, production can stagnate, as is revealed by a crisis. Once the profit motive has been removed, the development of the productive forces of society would finally be under the conscious control of human beings, who would benefit directly in the form of greater material wealth and shorter working hours. The productive activities of human beings would still be affected by external factors, such as natural disasters or pandemics. But no longer would production come to a grinding halt despite all the necessary material conditions for production being in place. There would, in short, no longer be any real basis for crisis to occur.